Hi. So I have a couple of co-authors, as you can see, and I'll introduce them as I go. They're all community partners in this project, Food Dignity, that I'm going to talk about. We have nothing to disclose. So we have embarked on a five-year research project called Food Dignity, action research on engaging food insecure communities and universities and building sustainable community food systems. I won't read to you all from all the slides. We started about a year and a half ago. We have $5 million from the USDA NIFA AFRI program, and we have 3.5 years to go to achieve some of the things we're aiming to do. So this is straight out of our application. Essentially, our project title signals both a stance that agency and food systems, people having control over their local food systems, is an end in itself, and also our scientific hypothesis that if we improve this kind of local control in food systems, that we'll actually end up with healthier, more equitable, and more sustainable food systems. Just as a backdrop, as if you didn't know, we've got a couple problems with our food system at the moment, including that 43% of the world is suffering from malnutrition, under, over, or both. That, of course, an industrial food system is not sustainable, peak oil, peak soil, which we're at or near or past. And that the movements, international and within the U.S., offer an ethical and hopefully a practical alternative to industrial food systems, or at least partly feed ourselves and our great-grandchildren, so we should be learning from the folks who are doing this work. And that is our goal in Food Dignity. We have 5 community partners, all of whom are co-authors in this presentation, and there they are. They've each provided me about a 90-second story that I'm going to share with you today about their work right now. So we're essentially doing 5 case studies of their work to date and what happens over the next 5 years, or these current 5 years, as well as our plus one case study is about the work of trying to do this together, the action research with university partners and these community partners. So essentially our core design is that each of the partner communities gets $60,000 a year for 5 years to support a community organizer, build a steering committee that largely determines how many grants are disseminated and to some extent how the research budget is spent for contributing to their case study. And then the 2 that are based in university towns have a community university liaison. And our methods include photo voice and interviews, participant observation, lots and lots of file collection and coding. We're also doing tracking harvests, the actual quantity that gardens are producing of fruits and of mostly vegetables. And we're tracking mini grants as sort of sub-research projects. So here are the stories from west to east. First, not far from here, is Dig Deep's Farms and Produce, and Hank Herrera, co-author, sitting right here with us today, is the general manager. He also works half-time Food Dignity-wide as action research coordinator. And then the other co-author there is Sergeant Marty Nideffer, who started the Deputy Sheriff's Activities League in Sherryland, Ashland, just south of Oakland, because kids didn't have anything to do. He was arresting them. They were getting in trouble. He said, do good, don't do bad. And they're like, there's nothing good to do. He started a soccer league, and now about 900 to 1,000 kids play soccer every summer. But then these kids, of course, are graduating, and as Marty puts it, they're going into a working-class community with no work. So he met Hank at an Alameda County Public Health Department meeting, I believe, and asked Hank, is this true, this idea of this green-collar economy? Can we make jobs out of food? And Hank crossed himself and said, yes. And they've been working together ever since on Dig Deep Farms and Produce. They've got 5 folks from the community who had no experience with urban farming but are now urban farmers, including having transformed this hillside, which is now also have an orchard. That's their largest farm. They've got some plots also downtown Ashland, Cherryland. So they're growing food, and they're distributing it. They're delivering in a food apartheid, food desert of Cherryland, Ashland. They deliver the food that they grow as well as some that they purchase from organic farmers and deliver them across Oakland and in Cherryland, Ashland, including the People's Grocery grub boxes. They prepare and provide those. Moving east, Wind River Indian Reservation is the Blue Mountain Associates there as a partner. Dr. Sutter is the lead there, and they have given out mini grants mostly for gardens. So they're admiring the produce and sampling it from somebody who got a mini grant who grew a garden for his diabetic grandmother, and he cooks food for her and a very large family that lives with them from this garden, and shares that zucchini is destined for zucchini bread at a farmer's market, I think. Another one of their mini grantees has been planting with their children, and they have one of the most beautiful gardens I have ever seen, including 3 kinds of Indian corn, and they're saving the seeds and sharing them with others on the reservation to restore Indian corn. back to become more available. They sell out whenever they sell it, the corn itself. And for the first time, they're preserving food, and they have enough to get them through the winter, they believe, of their fruits and vegetables from their garden, even in the Wyoming climate. And they also make about $100 a week selling their food at the relatively new farmers market. They're using the Food Dignity support in part to develop this new market that has three locations in Wind River Indian Reservation. And most of their many grantees are vending there. They've given out about $12,000 in many grants. Each of these projects has given about $12,000 out so far to start projects like these. Where I live now in Laramie, Wyoming, the main organizer there is co-author there, Gail Woodsum, and they have had Feeding Laramie Valley has helped to create the first city park-based community garden as part of their goal of creating a garden in every city park, a community garden. Those are my daughters enjoying the produce. Another main activity of Feeding Laramie Valley is supporting this development of our Laramie garden, where also my former student and co-author here, Peggy McCracken, dug up her front yard, and a friend of hers dug up a front yard to create a communal garden so people don't own their own plots. Anybody who wants to comes and helps, harvests, and they eat together. Peggy says that aside from actually getting quite a lot of food out of this garden, she made a lot of friends and met everybody in her new neighborhood. And now Feeding Laramie Valley has supported the development of a third garden. Here they are spreading llama poop in somebody's front yard, which all just got dug up a few weeks ago, including by some of my students in my food health and justice class are there. And so this is an idea that's spreading, unfortunately, in Laramie. There's no zoning against, you can do whatever you want pretty much in Wyoming with your property, including dig up your front yard and make a communal garden. So this is spreading. And a third project of Feeding Laramie Valley is called Sharing the Bounty, where they collect, as Gail puts it, the best of what we have, local, largely organic produce at the farmers markets. We have two in Laramie. And this summer, they collected $14,000 worth of food, and they distribute it, including but to order, from folks who are living in Laramie senior housing. And the story here is that watermelon was their favorite food. And in general, there was a little bit of strife over getting their fair share of of whatever comes in from the market. But there was a lady there who I'll call Mary, who was in chemotherapy, and the only food she liked to eat was watermelon. That's the only thing she could bear to eat during her chemo. So the distributor, Peggy, was slipping her extra watermelon secretly. After the melon season ended, she had to come in and say, "Sorry, there's no more watermelon." And all the ladies said, "Oh, we were giving all our watermelon to Mary. What is she going to eat now?" And then Whole Community Project in New York, Jamila Secure is the organizer there. She's been using the Food Dignity support to build a group of a leadership, a stronger base of leadership in the food movement there, and she brought them to Detroit to learn what's going on from the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network and D-Town Farms. And they then brought invited Charity Hicks of Detroit to come and visit in Ithaca and inspire people, including as keynote speaker at their second annual Food Justice Summit in Ithaca in September. East New York Farms in Brooklyn is our fifth community partner. They're the longest standing. They do farmers markets and youth programs and lots of community gardening. The director is Sita Sarita there on the left, and Daryl Marshall is the community organizer and is convening the steering committee there, who decides how they give out their mini grants. And just one of their favorite stories of their mini grants right now is to Ms. Garcia, who has been keeping bees for a while. This expanded her beekeeping operation. She does tours and training for other people to learn to keep bees. And now she's working with some people who are on her most recent tour to develop some products from the beeswax to sell at their farmers markets. So those are sort of just a very quick sort of highlights of those five, the kind of work those five places are doing. And then there's the case study between the edge and the fringe of actually trying to do this work. This was in Denver Airport until quite recently, which is a very standard idea about what universities are for and where expertise lives, which kind of is encapsulated on the left here. The expertise only comes from professionals or academics, trained people with formal education, as opposed to in an action research model, including in Food Dignity, that the expertise, and especially in the food movement, comes from people with the ground-to-ground experience. Ethics in the dominant paradigm of research is used last as opposed to first to decide what we want to know and how we're going to find it out. and the contrast between a sort of randomized controlled trial approach to knowledge that is perfectly generalizable versus stories as a valid research method, which is actually our main method, not the only, but the main method in food dignity. And one of our biggest struggles, I would say, is that the academics who are doing this work feel on the fringe, right? They're doing work on the right side hand of that table, and it's not respected. It can be hard to publish. One of our main agroecologists used to work at Rodale and was loved by organic farmers when she worked at Rodale, and then she moved to Cornell and is now hated because Cornell is really associated with big ag and organic farmers have a bad experience. So she feels very fringe both in the field from organic farmers as well as within her department, not to mention that there's some threat of horticulture being taken over by plant biology, which would be kind of like public health being taken over by a med school. Also, the main PI at Cornell, his department was actually dissolved. This used to be a Department of Education, and it's gone, and he lost his tenure with that. And so the academics feel very on the edge, very fringe, very challenged professionally. But that's nothing compared to how the communities feel, for whom it's life and death. Just for example, those are buffalo hides from the U.S. government policy in the late 1800s to try to eliminate or control the Plains tribes by slaughtering the buffalo, their main food source. Now, on Wind River Indian Reservation, the life expectancy is 49 years old. 49. So for communities, this is life and death. For the academics, less so, and this is a challenge in the project. And as one of our academic partners put it, for some of us, this is a project. For others, it's a way of life. And this is one of the main sources of our strife. I don't know if you're familiar with the chicken and pigs, but to a ham and eggs breakfast, the chicken contributes, but the pig commits. So in this case, the academics are more like chickens choosing where they lay, whereas the other folks who are really doing this and the work on the ground can't walk away. They're committed. So it leads to sort of an us and them issue. Even as we get closer from these academic fringes and the leaders and gatekeepers in this community, there's still a gap. Many people describe this feeling of not belonging. Let me read a couple of those. And as Hank here has put it, not only is it a no man's land, it's a non-existent land. We're trying to bring it into existence. And the main sources for me of this are this literature on bridging communities, and also this book, Dignity, the essential role it plays in resolving conflict. The strategies we're using in food dignity are essentially working from the heart and soul as much as from the head. That's more of an issue for the academics than it is for the community members in this project. We spend a lot of time together at our meetings, face-to-face, and more locally in our local contingents. We do a lot of co-authoring, presenting, co-designing. And, of course, the money to each community partner helps. They have a significant amount of control in this project in determining their stories, and bridge people who can work both sides and are comfortable in both places, like Hank or Peggy McCracken, who is a co-author here. And the academics are very interested in becoming part of the movement, not just doing this research. For roles for public health professionals, I think we get this about focusing on environmental change instead of individual behavior change. My other main point about, aside from all these other things that I just said, were to re-examine our positions in food safety, just because you need a different kind of food safety system to support local food production than for industrial food. Thank you. That was 13 minutes. Any questions? Are you?
Well, I would like to ask. I know that you're relatively new in this position, and it sounds very, like you're living on the edge a little bit. So, it's just very exciting that you've managed to get this much work done in such a short amount of time. And can you remind me again how much time the grant is for?
Yeah, so we have 5 years, which, for me, this is my life work, just like it's the life work for each of the community partners. But for this funding, we have 5 years. And so we're a year and a half in. And I have to say that I'm not as fringe, right? I got really lucky. I applied for this grant while I was still a PhD student at Cornell in community nutrition, from my to-be-started position at University of Wyoming. So unlike a lot of the partners, the academic partners who've been struggling like this their whole lives, I walked into an assistant professor position with a $5 million grant. So I don't, and while the work we're doing is kind of fringe and unusual, it's respectable just inherently because it's funded. So I don't have those same struggles, to be honest. I have it very lucky, and it's really on the shoulders of both the academics before me, but of course especially the work. I'm not doing the work. It's the community organizers and those community projects who are doing the work, and they've just have offered us the privilege and opportunity to learn from their work, including seeing when they get a little bit of extra support that's pretty flexible considering it's federal dollars. They're showing us their priority areas of investment. The mini grants, even though that's only $30,000 per place total, is for many of them the most exciting piece of the work, to be able to fund individual citizen ideas and action.
Thank you.